Other than yourself, who do you think is currently writing significant books about Kentucky history?
Well, let's leave me out of it. I think let's talk about some of the writers and leave out that significant business for a moment.
All right.
That's a judgmental thing, and I don't want to get into that.
Okay.
I've had three students, that justified my going into the field of teaching. Those three alone. There are others. But I think Harry Caudle, in his Night Comes to the Cumberland, wrote a book that any author would be proud just to fold his hands and rest on that laurel. Harry wrote other books, Theirs Be the Power, and the Moguls, and then those whimsical little books, The Lord and the Miner. That's not a whimsical book. But Harry awakened not only Kentucky, but a nation to a situation that's as pinching this morning as any issue in Kentucky could be, Appalachia. On downstream, there's another seminal author. I personally don't agree or disagree with him always, but I admire him enormously. He is a seminal person. He's almost pursuing the unrealistic dream of Thoreau and the land. But Wendell Berry, Wendell Berry is an important seminal author. And he's contributed mightily to the literature of this period in Kentucky history. In his way, John Ed Pierce has made major contributions. I look back, had all three of these boys in class, and they are people that Kentucky can be proud of.
Were they undergraduates when you had them?
They were undergraduates, yes. Oh. Excuse me, let me get this bug out of my throat. There's Otis Rice, one of my graduate students, has contributed significant books to the understanding of the early phase. It did Charles Talbot in his Benjamin Logan, tremendously important books. Laurel Harrison at Western has been a major contributor in the field of Kentucky history. I think Wade Hall has made important contributions. And I'm on very, very boggy ground right now because I'm going to leave out somebody that I'll kick myself for leaving out. Malcolm Jewell in Political Science has contributed major books in analyzing the political, modern political situation. Nancy Baird and Carrico have contributed, as Paul Fuller, and certainly the boy at Northern Kentucky. What is his name? I'm embarrassed. Has made an important contribution. I'll think of this boy's name in just a minute. one of the things that was a major contribution in the field of Kentucky, understanding Kentucky, was that so-called bicentennial bookshelf published by the University Press of Kentucky.
Yes.
That's an important backlog. I would have profited if I'd had those books back in when I was writing my history of Kentucky. Sure. If I'd had Otis Rice's books, if I'd had Charlie Talbot's Logan, John Bakeless, Daniel Boone.
But didn't they all profit from yours?
I don't know whether they profited at all or not.
Maybe they couldn't have written theirs without yours.
Oh, yes, they could have. We've come light miles away in the literature in the state, but we've got light miles to go. There's no history of agriculture for the state. There's no good history of women in the state. That George Wright has made major contributions in the field of black history in Kentucky. There's no history of the horse industry, which right now is in deep trouble.
Yes.
Or there's no history of the cattle industry in Kentucky. It's just crying to be done. There's a need for a good history of transportation. If you want to be specialized, just the highway system alone. And I could go on.
Do you know of people working on those?
No, I don't. Right now, there's being gathered some oral tapes on the family farm.
Yes.
We need what a marvelous book to be written on small town Kentucky.
Right.
Main Street Kentucky.
Right.
Just a phenomenally interesting book. Right. And we need a real good, honest-to-God, root-jerking history of education in Kentucky.
Especially
there have been several
now.
Books, but in the modern context of 940, House Bill 940, we need to go back and take a look at the main forces that have been at work in the field of education.
That
we need a good constitutional history of Kentucky. Pat Wadlington has contributed a major book in that area. Coward has contributed a major book. But we need to pull these things together and give them now some modern perspective.
Mm-hmm. Speaking about the history of education, one thing I wanted to ask you was if the state education reform leaders were to ask you about how you would change the way history texts are written, how would you respond?
I would respond to it in this way, that let's balance things in the writing of Kentucky history. Let's give serious attention to pioneer beginnings, and let's put that in proper context. Then let's search out the roots of establishing political institutions with some degree of continuity into the future. Then let's take another look at slavery and the context of slavery leading into black history development. Let's take a look at scientific developments in Kentucky. Let's analyze this matter of agrarian way of life. Let's take a second look at the creation of major figures in Kentucky history and put them in proper context. Let's examine the forces, the national forces, that have played such a enormous role in shaping the destiny of the state itself. Let's look at the impact of four major wars, the War of 1812, the Civil War and the two World Wars, to say nothing of the Korean War and the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And let's take all those things into consideration.
Right. What about history textbooks in general, in terms of national or world history? Do you think
all of them must be rewritten? The writing of textbook is a way for professors sometimes to enhance his economic condition.
Right.
But they're like last year's bird's nest. They are out of date. And I'm not making a very intelligent judgment there. Textbook writing has serious limitations.
Right.
Space, for instance.
Sure.
Readership. There are all kinds of limitations. And there are all kinds of dissatisfactions with textbooks.
Right.
The textbook has been... Is that for me?
Yes.
Let me... There's always been great dissatisfaction with textbooks. But
right.
Nobody's ever come up with a really satisfactory alternative.
Right.
And
I know
and
they
that's
always,
where the pinch lies.
I know they always need to be updated, but there always seems to be dissatisfaction
that's
with
right.
the contents anyway, that it should be more of this ethnic something or more of this type of culture, less of that.
In my own teaching, I never achieved success, be it said. But I always tried to tell students that you read the text, it's a guide. It gives you a sense of direction. But when you read the text, there are also books that throw light, much additional light, as a matter of fact, all the light on others, on subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And you should go way beyond the text. The text is simply almost a guideline, and can't be any more than that.
Sure.
Lord, oh Lord, I struggled during 23 years as chairman of the head of the Department of History here, trying to deal with that textbook issue.
Mm-hmm.
Try to find a text that would achieve something of lasting value in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And there were good texts. But now I've got a room full of textbooks down in South Carolina, and I've got a lot of them here in this house. And you look at them, they're old friends, but they've grown gray and doddery, and they are out of date now, and all of this young generation would poo-poo
mm-hmm.
those things in the past. Yet, they did represent an element, a very real element of solidity.
Right. Also, in terms of education, how history should be taught, I was just wondering how you feel about usually historical biographers or fiction writers who... not only tell what actual historical figures were doing in the past, which they can verify factually, but what they were thinking and how they were feeling.
Well,
that's
one individual
writer,
in my own opinion. Let's go back to something that you're introducing here. The historian is dedicated, that is, the dedicated historian is dedicated to trying to find the truth, trying to establish as much of the truth as he can, be it favorable, palatable, or unpalatable. The historian should not have any morals whatsoever. Should be thoroughly immoral in his attitude in this sense. He's not there to pass judgment. Let St. Peter do that. He's there to try to find what the facts were and interpret those facts with as much intelligence as he can muster. He's not there as a moral judge sitting in on the case. Yet he has an obligation not only to dig up the facts, but to organize them in some fashion so that they will have some chronological significance, or some sequential significance, or some intelligible consequence. He can never reconstruct a scene. You can't reconstruct the last hour, in my opinion. But you don't have to eat all of an egg to know whether or not it's a good egg. You can, in the use of documents, in the use of personal correspondence, in the use of editorial comments, all sorts of sources, you can pretty well construct what happened in a reasonable form that will give you a sense of the flow and the course of human events. It would be a very foolish historian to write and say, these are the facts. Mm-hmm. This is what happened, and say it with a conclusive positiveness. He doesn't know.
You're even talking about some things that might be in the realm of fact as well as the realm of human nature, human psychology.
That's right.
That you really can't
determine. In that matter of getting into the mind and the thought processes of individuals, the place where people reveal most intimately their thoughts, or at the same time conceal their thoughts, be it said both ways, or in personal letters, in diaries, diaries that are kept with no view to publication. Beware of a diary that's written with a view to publication.
Yes.
Because that's obscurantism first order. Sometimes in speeches, newspaper interviews, whatnot, you get an insight into the proceedings. But you know, when you're dealing with proceedings of organizations of all kinds, political, governmental, religious, or any kind, you oftentimes are dealing with facts that have been accomplished. And what you have to do is go behind that to see what influenced the arrival at those facts. The historian can only do the best he can. Mm-hmm. It depends on how sound his own judgment is, how sound his maybe his moral attitude is toward handling those facts, or how conscientious he is.
As many biographers of historical figures, at least one school of biography tends to say not only was Daniel Boone or Napoleon or Lincoln or whoever it may be, not only was he here, but this is what he was feeling when he committed this action.
Who knows?
Right, that's what I'm saying. You wouldn't endorse that school of writing.
No. You don't know the physical system of people. You don't know whether their digestive system is out of order. You don't know whether they are depressed in mind. You don't know whether they were over-optimistic or jubilant about something. They're all those things. Historian's not a psychologist. And a psychologist is not God.
And what they should be feeling, according to the historian, may not be what they were feeling.
Yeah, that may be true. That's where the novelist has it on the historian.
Or where the novelist may be, to get a good story, tangling up history a bit.
I want to touch on one source that a historian has to work with.
Uh-huh.
He would be woefully handicapped did he not have the newspaper press. But no historians have ever yet really come up with a good, sound answer as to how substantial the newspaper is as a source of information. Yet we depend on it. We quote them. And when I see I've seen many a newspaper reporter come and go, and I've seen them make all kind of blunders. Mm-hmm. You know it. You know what they said was not true. And they'll tell you. They have to grab it and run. Mm-hmm. They don't have time to go behind all these things.
Right.
And they are space confined and time confined. And politicians, you take a speech of a politician, it may be that that's what he thought, it may be just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
He may be obscuring everything he can.
He may not be writing his speeches either.
That's right. Quite true. And that's getting to be more and more true.
Right.
This matter of war on nation, a gentler nation, that now is known not to be original with Bush. That kind of tomfoolery
that
goes on.
Right.
Yeah. Tell the yahoos out in the diggings what you think they want to hear. It may be a reflective historical fact in that respect.
Of course, that's not what we all want to hear anyway.
That's right.
Do you believe students of history should be asked to write about history in school instead of simply to relate their knowledge by taking multiple choice tests and the like?
Oh, God deliver us from multiple choice test.
Well,
give a multiple choice test or even run out of the classroom. I abhor those things. That is no test of intelligence whatsoever. You make gamblers out of students. He cannot have any knowledge at all and almost guess by just common sense.
We talked about when you were going through school, you're being asked to write about history constantly, and so many students today are only asked to fill in the blanks or circle multiple choice questions for historical factual knowledge without reflecting on what any of it means.
I never knew whether I was a good teacher or not. When I used to go in class and hold this up and say, that's the one thing that makes a difference between you and a monkey. That one instrument right there.
Yeah.
That's the thing that challenges your mind to write intelligently, cohesively, comprehensively, whatever. But most of all, writing, stating as clearly as you can your thoughts. That's mm-hmm. the one instrument. Mm-hmm. And I'm holding up, in this case, a pen.
And would you say it's important to students, for students, not only to write the facts about what happened, but to write an essay somehow reflecting on those facts or interpreting them and making some sort of sense of them?
If you write something, number one, they have to be able to state their thoughts in some form or other. Mm-hmm. Something they maybe had never done before. Something that would reveal to them possibilities they didn't know they had. Mm-hmm. Or second thing, you've got to have some information to write about. And that necessitates your going and digging up something. And the third thing, you have to undergo review in the matter of instruction. If the professor is conscientious, then that student should get the benefit of criticism. Mm-hmm. And finally, and this is one of the things connected with authorship, there's the joy of having expressed yourself. And later on, you don't have to get somebody to write a letter of application for you. You don't have to get somebody to tell you how to dig up facts. You don't have to get somebody to tell you how to write something, mm-hmm. some instructions or whatnot. They don't have to tell you the joy that comes with the labor of writing. I think that's one of the things that maybe takes an author on and on, is the fact that there's some soul-satisfying thing about writing. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite serious. That's the one of several means possible, but that's the one major mean of drawing an individual out intellectually. That's the one way to mature the intellectual process. As a professor in the classroom, I never gave one of those damn so-called objective tests. That was bull of the first order. I never gave this. And I just abhor that kind of thing. That's one reason we're in the mess we're in education today. Second thing, in every course where this could be applied, I never let a student get out without writing a paper, mm-hmm. a paper of some length, mm-hmm. because I was trying to develop in them some originality, some skill at applying knowledge. Knowledge isn't worth a damn if you don't know how to apply it.
Right.
And that's mm-hmm. the one area where you can apply it.
Right.
Well, oh my, I just abhor the first place, and this is being pretty well proved in these national tests.
Yeah.
Who can really devise a thoroughly searching test without bugs in it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, during World War II, Army sent down those things every week, and we had to administer them to soldiers.
Yeah.
And they were, some of them were so stupid.
What were they?
They were testing American history.
Oh.
Objective, so-called objective test. We had no choice but to give them. But somebody in Princeton, in that testing service, had devised these things. Every week they had to devise a test so they could come up with some stupid stuff. I don't recall, except in one case, ever taking an objective test myself. But in a comical situation, I took a course, about the sorriest course that I ever took in college, in the field of education. And the old professor gave an objective test, And by gambler's choice, nothing else, by just pure gambler's choice, I made a 99 on it. No intelligence. And the next year, I kept up the golf course, and that old professor played out there, and he was always bragging on my 99 to me. But the next year, he came out and said, your record has been lowered. And he said, I had a boy make 100. Well, what had happened is that the old professor would just split off the answers and give the same test. Oh. That is, the same test papers. And in my case, he'd forgotten to slit off the answer, and the boy got this and saw it, and he just answered the one question there and slit the thing off himself and turned it in, 100%. That taught me that, first place, there wasn't any reason I made 99, just by sheer, pure luck.
Right. And, well, it amuses me how all disciplines, maybe with the exception of math, in the past incorporated so much writing. And then many school systems and teachers got away from this for years, and now they're going back to it as a whole new concept and calling it writing across the curriculum and teaching teachers to put writing into their courses. It's sort of hard to believe they got away from it. But.
Yes, it is. That's what education is all about. One thing, in this context, a professor in the classroom never knows what he's doing. He never knows what seed he might be planting, mm-hmm. both negative and positive. And when they bear fruit, it's a joy. And you never know those that you killed off. Interest. That's one of the things a historian has to work with.
Right.
I've had people, I guess so, heaven knows how many times, over and over, people say, I just hate history. Well, they don't hate history. That's like saying, I hate air. Everybody has a history. Everybody deals with history. You couldn't go home again if you didn't.
They don't look at
your way home
as having anything to do with themselves.
That's what they hate are those people who drill dates into them,
right.
And taught history by rote. That's what they hate. They hate the method, not the subject.
Those are generally the ones who have grown up taking the multiple choice
That's
tests,
right.
aren't they?
That's right. Yeah. They didn't see any meaning to it.
Right, just remember it and then forget it when the class is over.
And another point I want to make in the teaching of history, mm-hmm. you're always dealing with youthful minds in school. People who've had no experience or not much experience, who have not much perspective. All their perspectives are anticipatory,
uh-huh.
not back looks. Uh-huh. And the best you can do is to stimulate in them an interest that will grow in the future. And I used to tell students that what I'm saying to you now, these facts won't mean a whole lot to you ever, but we have to deal with them in order for you to get a sense of what's happened. But as you grow older and become more mature, the challenge of learning something about the past will grow, will become greater.
Either in teaching or in writing, mm-hmm. What have you found interests people in history who may not have been interested in it before?
Oh, I think the human incidents. I think a good teacher of history will never forget the humanity of the subject. And a little touch of humor mm-hmm. along helps. It's a lubricant that helps things along.
Do you have a favorite historical anecdote you've written about and you could retell now?
Anecdote. Oh, I love the things in Rampaging Frontier. I've always liked the turn of the American mind that exaggerated things, partly because he was out in wide open spaces, and enormous resources around him, living free and easy, and scared to death, partly telling these stories to bolster his courage, or just plain cussedness.
Would you tell these stories in the classroom?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes you could get your point over telling those easier than you could dealing with facts.
Is there one you could recall now?
No, I don't. I heard Bob Remini the other day telling one that I used to tell students about that old story about Henry Clay and John Randolph Roanoke being at outs. Just Randolph was in Clay's hair all the time, and he was Clay as Speaker of the House, and Randolph coming in with those dogs, and Clay making the sergeant-at-arms get the dogs out of there, anything to aggravate him. And Clay and Randolph were on a walk meeting, and Randolph pulled up and said, "Sir, I'll step aside to let no skunk by." And Clay bowed politely and stepped aside and said, "Sir, I will." That sort of thing gives a little human touch.
Right.
See them as human beings, not some dead, dying thing. Oh, it'd be hard for me to come up right now with an anecdote, but sometimes the situation in class will stimulate the use of one.
Are there trends in writing about history now in the national or international scene that you'd like to comment on,
yes,
positively or negatively?
Yes. I think these young historians are going haywire right now. Maybe I'm looking at it from an age-old perspective that's out of date. Maybe I'm an archaic historian, but I think we're generating books just by the hundreds, literally by the thousands. I go to the, I almost don't go to the professional meetings anymore, but when I do, I went to the one in Louisville, and the publishers are there with literally thousands of books. Mm-hmm. And I think, who in the name of God is going to read all of these books, and if they read them, what would they amount to anyway? And the libraries are just being stacked, tight. I was in the stacks yesterday. Just rows and rows and rows of books. And I wonder who takes those books down and reads them. They're there. Mm-hmm. They're not out. That's self-evident. I think our young historians have become taking an adversarial position. They're crusading right now. Women, Indians, blacks, urban, we're shifting over from an age of old agrarian historians or agrarian background to urban historians. And
so instead of sweeping histories of continents or cultures, you're seeing compartmentalized,
that's right,
ethnicized, that's right, histories.
Quite true.
All
the colleagues that I talk with seem to be disturbed in the same way. And the correspondence that I have with old colleagues, they're disturbed about it. The journals are just full of this stuff.
How much of that do you think is the fault of or the cause of universities and colleges that forced people to publish or perish from?
Oh, I think that it's like injecting cancer cells into the academic system, that publish or perish.
I mean, but do you think that's now, probably the cause?
If I may make a personal reference here, I obviously desperately needed to get an advance in salary because I started at a low salary. And my economic situation for years was just touch and go. I obviously wanted to be promoted. And one way to do that was to establish yourself as a scholar. Mm-hmm. But I would hate to think that that was the only objective I had in writing. I think I can say with a fair degree of truth that I had an urge, really.
Right.
You don't write books. You don't sit down those long nights and long days, and you don't forego the things that ordinary human beings do. You don't go to plays. You don't go to musical events. You don't go to amusement parks. You don't do all those things. You don't go touring around and write books. You just can't do it.
Right.
And if your only objective is getting promoted and advancing your economic situation, that would be as empty an objective as I can imagine. I do not remember two things. I do not remember ever really being concerned about tenure. I just don't have any recollection of that. Now, do I remember when I got tenure? I just barely remember when I got promoted from instructor to assistant professor after about 4 or 5 years service, which was an unusually long period.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Then I got promoted to associate professor in a rather short time. And just by fortuitous circumstance, I was made professor. When I was made head of the Department of History as a young professor, I was promoted to full professorship.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I had not been concerned about that. That thing came so fast on me, I hadn't even thought about it. Then I was promoted to distinguished professor. That was something I had never anticipated, and nobody else in the University of Kentucky had. They just created those 10 professorships, and I got one of them.
And were your publications
yes,
largely?
I think so, and I think service to the university. I would like to think service to the university.
Uh-huh.
That's something. But publish or perish. I had to deal with that as head of the department. I had a publishing department, Hopkins, Kerwin, Eaton, McCloy, Cray, and so on down the line. They were all publishing scholars.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to, Cone, I didn't have to put any pressure much on them. I had some who never published anything, couldn't have. Shouldn't have, maybe. No department can be made up of publishing scholars. Now, I would like to think that these people that I mentioned, and I have ample reason to believe, were good teachers.
Right.
And they were better teachers because they were research and publishing scholars.
Right. It just seems
I think in my own teaching that I hope it didn't enrich my teaching process.
Sure.
I would like to think that was true, but who knows?